Also, as an immigrant, you know, I live in the UK. I went to a private school for boys, you know, that was so British, you know. And for the rest of my life, I've been adapting to situations and going deeply into my culture and then going deeply into other people's cultures. And I think it makes you want to find a center in that way.
Questioning, who am I after all?
In a lot of ways, yes. You know, I find that freedom right now in the music and improvisation and our cultural ideals as well.
Danke fürs Einschalten und herzlich willkommen hier beim Elbphilharmonie Talk. Wir sind Julika und Tom. Und Tom, in dieser Folge hast du ja gesprochen mit dem in Südafrika geborenen Cellisten Abel Sielautschu, der mithilfe eines Stipendiums damals tatsächlich aus einem Township bei Johannesburg ans College nach Manchester gekommen ist und von da aus eigentlich ziemlich schnell tatsächlich die großen Bühnen der Konzertwelt eroberte. Seine Familie lebt aber noch in dem Township,
richtig? Ja, ja, ja. Da sprechen wir auch drüber. Also die Eltern sind noch im selben Township, in dem er groß geworden ist, und sein Bruder lebt auch noch dort. Und das sind, glaube ich, die beiden oder die drei wesentlichen Bezugspersonen, über die er jedenfalls am meisten gesprochen hat, auch seiner Familie.
Auch für seinen musikalischen Werdegang spielt der Bruder eine große Rolle, oder?
Ja, absolut. Also ich glaube, er verdankt ihm wahnsinnig viel, angefangen von der Wahl des Instruments bis zu dem Umgang mit dem Instrument. Und ich glaube, wir haben nicht darüber gesprochen, ob der Bruder ihn dann auch noch sehr ermutigt hat zu sagen, ey, geh da, sieh zu, dass du das Stipendium kriegst, aber ich hau dem das sofort zu.
Wahl des Instruments, Umgang mit Instrument, das ist ein gutes Stichwort, denn Abel ist nicht nur Cellist, sondern er singt auch und er komponiert, und zwar so erfolgreich, dass er tatsächlich mit diesen Werken auch wirklich gut unterwegs ist im Moment. Und in seiner Musik verbindet er grundsätzlich diese eher so europäische klassische Musik mit der Musik seiner Heimat. Daher kommt auch das Singen, habe ich das richtig verstanden?
Ja, das Singen, auch sein Style des Singens hat schon sehr viel mit Südafrika zu tun. Er kann diese Click-Sounds wunderbar artikulieren. Und ich glaube, dass der Spirit des Gesangs tatsächlich ganz stark davon herrührt, wo er herkommt aus seiner Kultur. Da sprechen wir auch drüber. Und natürlich ist das europäische oder abendländische Singen ihm auch nahe gekommen über die Jahre und Jahrzehnte seiner Beschäftigung mit Musik, das ist ganz klar.
Das Tolle ist ja dann, dass er tatsächlich auch in seinen Konzerten oft das Publikum animiert, so ein bisschen mitzumachen. Also ich erinnere, dass er hier im März 25 hat er eigentlich den großen Saal zum Singen gebracht. Ich habe es nur im Livestream erlebt damals, aber das war ziemlich einmalig.
Ja, ja, er ist, das hat er jetzt hier zuletzt im Juni in Hamburg auch gemacht. Also das ist seine Natur. Er ist mit so einem etwas altmodischen Wort gesagt, er ist so ein Menschenfischer. Die Leute sind einfach von seinem Charisma total gefangen genommen, oft das Schönste. Und wenn er anfängt, dieses Publikum in einzelne Sektionen zu unterteilen und mit ihnen zu singen, dann ist das, hat das fast so eine, der Name fällt, glaube ich, auch einmal bei uns im Gespräch, es hat so eine Bobby McFerrin-Qualität. Also dieses Verbindende, da ist zwar jemand auf der Bühne, der das alles wahnsinnig gut kann, aber er möchte unbedingt mit diesen Menschen zusammen dieses Erlebnis gestalten. Er würde sich, glaube ich, unendlich langweilen und oft einsam fühlen, wenn er ganz alleine da vorne irgendwas abspulen würde. Er braucht diesen Kontakt und er braucht diese Rückkopplung auch von den Menschen. Und er will sie hören, weil er weiß, dass es ihnen anders geht, wenn sie sich hören, wie sie dreistimmig irgendwas singen, was er ihnen frisch beigebracht hat.
Das Gespräch war ja wirklich auch irgendwie schnell sehr persönlich und vertraut, oder?
Ja, 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 weil man möchte mit ihm auch so reden. Man möchte mit ihm einfach über die wesentlichen Dinge sprechen. Und er hat gleich angefangen, auch über seine Tochter zu erzählen. Und er ist einfach ein ehrlicher Mensch. Er ist ein charismatischer, ehrlicher, besonderer, toller Typ.
Bevor wir zu viel vorwegnehmen, würde ich sagen, viel Spaß beim Hören.
Ja, bitte. Habt ihr.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
It is really such a joy and such an honor to have you here, dear Abel. I want to pronounce your last name because you told me once how to pronounce it. I just want to make sure I got it right. It's Sielautschu.
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 Yeah, so imagine it as C-H-O-E, so
Chue.
Yeah, yeah.
It's even more complicated than I remember.
Or C-H-W-E.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Chue.
Chue.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
You have come to this world, not only the world of music, I feel, but also to this world of people as like a natural force, really reshuffling the game in a way. And I wonder how that feels for you. We met, I think, 2 years ago, and it was first time you came to Hamburg, I think, first time you were in this area, and so much has happened in between.
Yes.
Your career has, like, I avoid the word exploded, but it has grown in a way that's quite mesmerizing. And I just want to know, how does that feel with all what you have come from? Mm. Because it really has made this rocket steep ascension in the last 2 years.
I mean, there's two parts to this, you know. I think there's the outside part, that's to do with the perception of people. And there's also my personal journey as a human being and figuring out how to keep on being myself, because that's the point of the music that I make. I think the perception of people out there is wonderful. And, you know, I really appreciate what people tell me they get from it. And that's a big deal for me. And it gives the idea of making music a real purpose, you know, every day. You know, for the days I don't feel like practicing, that's maybe what I could think about a little bit, about how this kind of feeds the soul. And it makes being busy a better idea, you know. I was thinking about it. A friend of mine said the other day, you know, like looking at the bees pollinating the flowers, it's like, they're so busy.
Yeah.
But they're all busy for like a greater good.
For a cause.
Yeah. And that's a gorgeous thing to think. And in the days that I feel, you know, really tired or depleted, and I'm still super busy trying to either create music or going to another country to play, I think I have to remind myself of the effects of the music and what it does. And that brings me back
to keep you up.
Yeah.
To keep you going.
And it keeps my purpose going, because I think so much happens in life, and sometimes life feels like a little bit long, actually. Like life goes on, and there's so much that happens. Even sometimes it's within a short space amount of time.
Yeah.
And you have to keep your why in check, basically. And so that's really rewarding, you know, from an audience perspective. But from a personal one, I think it's a wonderful thing to play everywhere. But I have to take care of my mental state, my spiritual state. It's very important, you know, for me to be able to do the, you know, the thing that people so enjoy. It's important for me. And I'm learning a lot about myself through this time, and learning again how to regulate the emotions of playing really meaningful big concerts where, I don't know, your dopamine is like flying. Yeah, it's like really up there. And then the next day, you know, I'm cleaning the floor at home because my daughter threw food everywhere. You know, so
reality check.
And beautiful reality checks, and but also, you know, really big dips in chemicals.
Yeah,
and to regulate that is just super important, but also to keep connected as a human being to my family, to those that are around me. I think humans are a bit like wolves. We are packs, you know. We're like, even sometimes you really enjoy the time alone. Just knowing that there are people around you that you can trust, and that love you without conditions, you know, without being a good musician. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
So those are the things for me, those two worlds that I'm, you know, often traversing and bridging together. And knowing that music has value, but it's not all of my value, you know. It's a big part of me, but I also, you know, want to be loved without conditions.
So good. So healthy also, you know.
Yeah, learning how to be.
How old is your daughter?
She's 16 months now.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
And is she traveling with you right now, or does she stay at home?
Sometimes she travels with us, yeah. My partner is also a musician, so we go everywhere. So we spent a month in Australia, and that was big, a long flight for a one-year-old.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we traveled to some places together, and the last time, in fact, we played here, our daughter was here, which was gorgeous, and we played my cello concerto with the Aurora Orchestra.
When you were with the Aurora Orchestra.
Yeah. That was gorgeous.
Fabulous. How does she respond to the music that you make and your partner?
You know,
does she dance? Is she?
Yes, she's a mover and shaker.
Cool.
And she's, you know, this is her normality. You know, she doesn't know any other world where there isn't music.
Yeah.
And there isn't practicing in the house, or she's not running around during sound check. She doesn't have that life. Whereas I grew up in a very different way, you know. I think the only time I discovered the word sound check, I was like much older.
Sure. So, yeah. You told me when we met last time, you told me you would, in the beginning, you would walk by foot to your cello class and to your course, together with your brother, who was a bassoon player. He's the older one, right?
He's an older brother, yeah.
So he would like mentor you in a way or help you?
Yeah, yeah.
All these legendary stories are you know, known about you, you know, having a broomstick instead of a cello in your early years. This vocation, that this would be the instrument, how did this come along? Where did you hear the instrument for the first time to know, the cello, this is my instrument?
It's a little bit like my daughter, you know, like the world that was presented to me was simply my world. And I think I was young and malleable enough to be presented with things and to take them in without a gate of judgment or if I really love it or if I really hate it. You know, so my brother was big into music, great bassoon player, as you've said, and he was... For some reason, he was a future teller in this moment of our lives. He, you know, he knew my potentials, and he would watch me a lot for my likes and for my dislikes and where I needed to work harder. And he actually was a father figure in that way, you know.
How much of an age difference do you have?
8 years.
8 years. Okay, yeah. That's quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
That's quite a bit.
I was quite late in the family. I've got two other sisters who are also much older than my brother.
Okay,
yeah,
so there's a
big gap, you know.
Yeah.
So he was really conscious by that point, and he was in his teens, and I was 9, you know, and he was starting to figure out the realities of life and knew that the poverty that we are in at home is something that we needed to shed and to find a way to get through into the next bracket of life. And I think he saw music for the expression that it was, but also for the access to the world it would give us. And and he chose the cello for me. He was like, I will choose the cello for you. Because he'd also seen his friends play it, and he was playing bassoon. And I guess that realm is like, you know, bassoon has a very beautiful sound.
Oh, yeah.
It can sing, you know. If we think about the beginning of The Rite of Spring, the beautiful classics... It's not just a bassline instrument. And I think he saw that and was like, I need to affect my brother in the same way, but it doesn't have to be the same instrument. You know. So he introduced me to the cello, fully well knowing that it would give me a versatility to sing, but also to support.
Yeah.
And as a 9-year-old, I had no idea of that. You know.
But he had it all mapped out.
He had it all mapped out. And you know, I think I fell in love with the people that played the cello more than I fell in love with the cello itself. It's like you fall in love with a teacher and the subject comes a bit later. And I think that's what happened with the cello.
And I reckon the people you heard were those people you would see play the cello. You weren't watching TV or videos and trying to get into the instrument, or was that also part of your early education?
That came a bit later. You know, I think there was a need to show you the example of what it can do, you know.
The
breath, like where it goes.
And
I still remember, I think the more immediate thing was taking the instrument and making it your own. So my brother, again, was a great teacher. So he brought together different guys from churches in the township. And some of these churches are rivals, you know. So he brought them different brass bands, woodwind bands, and brought them together and taught them how to read music. Because usually they use solfège, but you know, help them with staff notation. And then he began to write these incredible arrangements for them. And they had a band, and he'd say, you know, bring your cello. And I'd be there playing, being the only cello kid in the band, you know, this instrument that didn't quite fit in, but he was like, fit it in. We're going to do this African hymn. We're going to do this, you know, rhythmic music, you know, find a way to get in here. And I think that was like a beautiful thing that kind of dissolved the boundaries of what the cello should be.
And did he write out the parts for you too, or did he give you some permission to find out your own way?
Permission.
Permission.
Find your own way. read the euphonium part, you know, figure it out.
So cool.
Yeah.
Because, you know, your approach to the instrument still seems so utterly genuine, you know, if you compare this, you know, with all these people who have certain, I mean, they study the instrument to death, like 8-10 hours practicing a day, and they're trying to work it all out. And for me, when I see you play and when I listen to you playing, it's like your own, it's really like your voice. You're doing technically totally interesting things on the instrument, but it's totally your own. It's your unique style. Mm. Also taking the cello like a guitar or so, you know, having the energy to bring it into. So there's a freedom that you bring, I think, also to other cellists, just to show them, you know, you are not bound to really have it always upright, you know, and to the accuracy that they are studying for such a long time.
Mm.
And that's also why I say you are like a force of nature also in the world of music, for people to say, okay, you can, I could do different than I have done before. You know, like they would say about jazz singers who would be trained opera singers and they had a liking for jazz. And then the teachers would say, stay away from that because it'll ruin your voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I wonder, maybe sometimes people are watching you and saying, I want to do this. I want to be more like this. And then the teacher would say, no. Cello needs to be played upright.
I mean, I owe it to the people I was with, you know. And sometimes I think I owe some of my creativity or thought process to the lack of access we had, you know. The lack of money to buy sheet music or, you know, to learn techniques from other people that we didn't have access to, you know.
Because you were the only cellist in town.
Yeah, exactly. And it was like this. But also the same way, you know, I remember my brother teaching, you know, with this group that he'd created. And there was a euphonium player that couldn't afford a mouthpiece. And he was playing this euphonium without a mouthpiece. Oh. It was mind-blowing. And it sounded so beautiful. And it was a totally different sound. And I think he got a mouthpiece at some point. But my brother was like, the sound that you create through that is not the same, you know? Is it okay that you play like this? And the guy was like, yeah, sure. Like,
and you continue to do it without the mouthpiece.
And this was now a new sound that we had. And I just felt like approaching the cello in the same way would give back a lot. And also it was by situation. You know, I remember learning the bassoon concerto, Mozart's bassoon concerto on cello because it was in bass clef.
Sure.
And tenor clef.
Sure.
And I was like, that's how
we'll
do it.
That's familiar.
Yeah, and I use that. And I'm still all forever looking for inspiration from how people do their things and never forgetting to keep on imitating like other people, you know? I think there's a beautiful thing in that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you one of those kids who would sing before you would talk?
Did you sing before you spoke?
My daughter did. Uh-huh. My daughter sang a little before she talked. She sang quite beautifully, to be honest.
Wow.
I was quite surprised. Oh,
Does she still remember this? Does she have a memory?
Not really. I keep telling her, you know, I would carry her on my shoulders and I would sing to her and she would sing and we would sing and somehow and then she would fall asleep and then I would carry her. So.
Wow. That's gorgeous. Well, I don't remember like your daughter.
But maybe your parents told you at one point or your older brother.
No, they never did. It was, I guess, you know, in a very different way. I'm so, again, grateful to the African upbringing we had. It was like sound was a big part of our lives, you know. Noise was a huge part of our lives. We live in a small space with maybe 2 to 3 rooms or 4 rooms at most. And there's no privacy in the way that you'd...
Thin walls.
Thin walls and, you know, my sister's like belting songs in there, me trying to practice Bach in there, my dad watching football in the other room. And it's just like cacophony, but everybody's comfortable in this because that's what we're used to.
What you're used to, yeah.
And I just think there was music all the time. And, you know, say there's a suburb in Hamburg, you know, it's generally quite quiet in general.
Depending on where you were.
Actually, that's a good thing to bring up. And in the township, you know, people prided themselves with their sound systems. Yeah.
To be really like,
and with the kind of speaker you would buy and the kind of vinyl player you would have. And they would put it outside on the gate and they'd play their sound. And you'd walk around and be just
surrounded by all kinds of
many music, jazz guy, old guy doing his garden, a boy listening to house music, you know, and another lady who's a traditional healer listening to her traditional stuff, all of that stuff. And I think that was part of just a melting pot. And I think maybe the gift was from my brother saying, awareness, check it out. You know, like that guy over there is playing that and that guy is playing that. Yeah.
How is your brother doing now?
He's good. Yeah, he's good.
Is he in South Africa or did he also move to England?
No, he's in South Africa. Yeah. No, he lives in Cape Town now and he has a family. And in the later years, he decided to move to the jazz world, actually, a little bit.
With a bassoon.
And he tried. He did.
There are a few bassoonists in jazz, but very, very rare.
Yeah. So, I know one who's like insane, an American guy. Cool. He started playing a bit of jazz on bassoon and playing a lot of African music on bassoon. But then he decided that he moved to saxophone because he could feel the relation. And then he started working with a police band. And that became his like life. So he arranges music for them. And he still plays in the band over there. Yeah, and that's his life. And they live a very beautiful, family-driven life, which I envy and love. Yeah.
And your parents are still in the township where you grew up?
Yes, they are.
Do you go visit occasionally? Do you have time to do that?
Yeah, yeah. And, it, you know, the older they get, as you know, you might know with, you know, parents who are getting on, it's like you gotta see them all the time. And sometimes it doesn't hit you enough. You know, you have to create the urgency that actually not every day is a for sure. So I'm starting to feel a bit more like that now. So I will.
Being a father yourself now,
you get a
different perspective on how things move.
Yeah. Big hit.
Yeah. I want to speak a little more about the voice, about the singing, because that's so essential to your art, I find, you know, because all this playing and singing is kind of a seamless utterance of your being, or this is at least how it appears, you know. Sometimes you feel like you finish something that you began on the cello, you finish by singing and vice versa. So there is this intricate entanglement between those both two voices.
Yeah.
And then you have this enormous range, you know, this lower, you know, like the Tuvans would do the throat singing, you know, very, very low.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the click sounds come in between. And
yeah. Yeah.
Is this an art that you need to hone, or is this something that you just own and you can be happy that you can just dispose of?
Certainly, everything needs to be honed.
Yeah.
You know, in the world, there's an art of everything. Yeah. I just feel like I have a few inspirations of people that I, you know, kind of was searching and looking at and that play their instruments and sing very beautifully. And it's a labor of love, you know. And the first beginning, the genesis of singing and playing is extremely natural. It's like, oh, I can do communicate both on these planes, you know. And then, like anything, it's like, oh, stopgap, gate. Okay, are you going to improve yourself and learn? Are you going to sing a different melody and play a bass line, you know? Are you going to sing
independently?
Yeah, sing independently, or, you know, how in tune can you sing with yourself, with the instrument? Or, and it becomes one instrument, you know, the more you learn. And I think some of this was forced through by the idea of playing solo shows, you know. And I think the solo show as an art form is a, you know, a hugely important art form, I think, of any art, be it, you know, dance or playing music or, you know, visual art. Being alone sometimes is like, it shows you yourself, you know, and how challenging it is to play for an hour by yourself and flow and improvise and write music for yourself and feel the world. And sometimes maybe feeling like you don't have to feel everything and people will imagine what they should hear or things like this. So you spend a lot of time like that. Bobby McFerrin, a guy called Lionel Luweke.
Oh, yeah. Guitar player from South Africa. Incredible.
Yeah, from Benin.
From Benin. Yeah.
I mean, again, looking at him, you know, the incredibly rhythmic world that he takes. He has an album called In a Trance, and it's like extremely cosmic. And I think,
oh, wonderful.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time there thinking, oh, maybe this is what I'm going to begin imitating. And
this is where you're. And might take you.
Yeah, and it was also like he took the guitar and made it into, you know, an African instrument again, you know. Yeah, like kalimba,
mbira,
and ngoni and all of these like sounds, and you put paper inside and you'd get all these adventurous sounds that were like, oh, that's not a guitar, man, you know. And I think I owe, you know, some of my imagination to those worlds, yeah, and those
yeah.
people.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And then going to Bach and to Marin Marais, playing this beautiful period music, and again taking it into your world. This is also a bold move in a way, you know, especially if you're in Europe, you know, it's almost like sacred, you know, it has to be this way. And again, you stir up stuff in people's perception. But you do it with such a big heart that, you know, I think pretty much nobody can resist this, you know.
It just makes me laugh. I don't know. Makes me feel like curious, you know.
Yeah.
And carefree if you do the work, you know. Carefree if you fall in love with the harmony, you know. Carefree if you fall in love with the style that in turn opens maybe a connection between your culture and that culture, if you find it. And in some ways, I don't care enough for the audience's response when it comes to that. Yeah, it's important that it doesn't hold me back.
That's so good.
Yeah.
That's really so good.
Yeah.
So, of course, and we're returning to the beginning of the conversation. You're very aware of what people's responses are. When you come on stage, you change the energy in the room in a way, you know, and they are willing to be taken someplace else by you performing. And I see the burden it takes. And then I saw you do stuff where I figured, well, this is maybe some ancestral thing coming up in you. So you are being held by generations and generations that you have in your back, supporting you invisibly for us, but very palpable probably for you. Can you say something about that? Is that something that I'm just fantasizing, or do you really feel like...
Oh man, that's crazy. No, it's not a fantasy. I think it's not a fantasy at all. I think the thought of like the people that came before you and the people that came before them, and that's why you are, like the set of circumstances are crazy that you are, because all of these people...
Configurated in a way.
Have done this. And, you know, that's, again, precisely just the beautiful genome of nature. It's like boundlessly technological, boundlessly, you know, miracle.
Mysterious.
Yeah. And I actually think it's not even just about me. I think it's about the human race. I think if really you think about the journey that people took and the burdens that they took so you can be alive, it's kind of crazy, even if it's by coincidence, you know. And I just want people to think like that often. And when I say, you know, think of your ancestors, I also think, you know, they're not always far away. There are people who are probably still with us in a way, but who lived in a different time. Or, I just somehow feel like it's something that should empower every person. And if you just simply imagine, you know, your parents with their hands on your shoulders, your mom and dad on your left and right, and behind them, their mom and dad. And behind them, yeah, it's just, for me, it's just a really mind-blowing image that makes me feel that there's a real reason and a purpose that I'm around for what I do. And again, that whole thing that I was talking about, that unconditional love that you should receive and that you inherit by simply being born and being around.
By which you are being held also.
Yes. And I use that method and thinking sometimes when I feel a bit of turbulence inside, whether will this be good enough or will this be... And I sometimes think, you know, sometimes I imagine I've been preparing this for the longest time before even I got here. So what's to say that this situation should distract me, you know, from my path of how I am and how I think.
Mm-hmm. Do the ancestors listen when you play?
Yeah. For me, they do. I speak to them. I laugh with them, you know. They are a part of my orbit and my imagination and my love for the people that have gone before me. And I do research about them. Oh. You know, the other day I found out that our tribe, we have a totem. Mm-hmm. And the animal is what we call piri, which is like a wild hog.
Oh.
Yeah.
And so flying being.
Yeah, a wild hog is like a...
A hog, not a hog.
A hog.
Yeah, a pig.
Yeah, exactly. They have pride in their adaptability and ability to take away conflict. And that's crazy. So I look into that lineage and go, flip, I feel a real purpose in that.
And the connection to this, and to these qualities also.
Yeah, and also...
What's the name of this totem again?
Piri.
Piri.
Yeah, Piri, yeah. And basically, like, it also teaches you about the tendencies that your ancestors would make and bend themselves to situations maybe that they maybe had to at that time, but you have the instinct to do, but you shouldn't necessarily do that.
Okay.
So we learn from... I don't know, the mistakes of our ancestors too.
So that you can correct stuff.
Yeah, and then that you can live a fulfilled life. And I think my adaptability is something that's within me big time. And that is a big force of nature, but can go both ways, you know, and I forever manage.
So it reminds you to really stay in your own truth.
Yeah, exactly. And my own truth. And also as an immigrant, you know, I live in the UK. And even as a musician from the township, I've had to cross into this like classical world, and you know, and I went to a private school for boys, you know, mm-hmm. that was so British, you know, and also so rich and had you know affluence and money, and I was there on the basis of a scholarship, but a boy who knew nothing about that.
So you stuck
world.
Out big time from
all the time, and for the rest of my life, I've been adapting to situations and going deeply into my culture and then going deeply into other people's cultures. And I think it makes you, you know, want to find a center in that way.
Questioning who am I after all?
In a lot of ways, yes.
Yeah.
And we find, you know, I find that freedom right now very much in music and improvisation and our cultural ideals as well.
And in connecting with people who are responding to this and maybe also in situations that are not so different, you know, other musicians who are crossing cultures and
yeah.
who you play with. Are you still in Manchester?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Love it over there.
Great.
Yeah.
Abel, it is wonderful sitting here with you, and I don't want to disturb you too much because I also know you have to take good care of your voice and to be a little quiet before you perform.
Thank you.
Really looking forward to listening to your show tonight.
I appreciate you. Thank you. What a beautiful conversation. Thank you.
Das war der Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie mit ausgewählten KünstlerInnen aus unserem Programm. Wenn du keins der Gespräche mehr verpassen willst, abonnier uns doch einfach auf deiner Lieblingsplattform und lass natürlich gern immer eine Bewertung da. Für Tickets und Infos zu den Konzerten in Elbphilharmonie und Leisthalle besuche uns auf www.elbphilharmonie.de. Dort findest du in der Mediathek auch weitere Podcast-Formate sowie viele Konzertstreams, Interviews, Hintergrundartikel und spektakuläre Musikvideos.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie. Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.
Viva la Podcast. Podcasten muss sich wieder lohnen.
Wir bieten dir kostenloses Podcast-Hosting ohne Limitierungen.
Du kümmerst dich ums Podcasten.
Und wir kümmern uns um den Rest.
Und das Beste daran, du verdienst auch noch Geld. Ab dem ersten Hörer.
Der ersten Hörerin. Besuche uns auf kostenlos-hosten.de und informiere dich.
Teure Hostingkosten müssen nicht sein. Kostenlos-hosten.de. Die Podcast-Re-Evolution.